Even as the sun envelops and warms your earth, giving it light and heat always, so shall this love power be known of men and respected of humanity. Think what this will mean, when money will not have to be under the lock, when mortals will cease to bear false witness against each other and joy shall reign king. The Day of Reckoning. James Howard M.C. Connell. I stood and gazed at my corpse under its winding sheet as it lay there so cold, so stark and stiff. For I had died, but I could not get away from myself, from that part of me that was stretched so lifeless there. And so I gazed on in wonderment and mute appeal. Beside my bier sat the woman who for 30 years was my wife. For a long time she sat still with folded hands lying idle in her lap, almost as immovable and quiet as my cold corpse. Then she began to weep, at first softly, the tears rolling quietly down her cheeks and finally with great sobs that shook and racked her slender frame as a tree is writhed in a winter storm. After a while the door opened gently and my wife's sister came in. She paused just within the threshold, looking at my wife in wide-eyed astonishment, and then she said almost roughly to her, "Why do you grieve for him? No husband ever treated a wife worse. He was cruel and selfish, and ill-tempered, dissipated and unfaithful to you, and in all the years that you have been married he has brought you nothing but suffering and anxiety and shame and poverty. You should thank God for your deliverance and that you can at least pass the balance of your life in quietness and peace." "I know," answered my wife passionately, "and I do not weep for him. I weep for myself that is dead. I mourn for my lost youth, for my lost happiness, for all that life might have given to me and what he took from me. My dear. Oh, my dear. Oh, my very dear," murmured her sister, laying her hand compassionately on my wife's shoulder. "Do you remember what a pretty girl I was?" she said, speaking in a dull level voice of hopelessness that was sadder than her tears. "Do you remember how pretty I was? I can speak of that girl now as if she were some other person, so remote she seems from me, so long it is since I have seen her picture smiling back at me when I looked into a mirror. But oh, how pretty she was, with that beauty that is like the beauty of the dawn, or of the springtime, all tender pinks, and blues, and golds, and sunshine. She had cheeks that were like roses, and eyes the color of blue cornflowers, and hair that was like ripe wheat. Can you realize that that radiant creature could ever have been I? Yes, it was. After I married, people said how soon I faded, and they wondered at it. They could not know that it was the brine of bitter tears that washed the color from my eyes, nor the long night, when I watched and waited for the drag of a drunken footstep coming up the street, that faded the roses from my cheeks as if an untimely frost had fallen on a June garden. In those first 3 years after I was married, I laid the costly offering of my beauty on the altar of an unhappy marriage. Day by day I saw myself grow old and ugly before my time, and when a woman does that she has served her purgatory here on earth." "Hush, hush," breathed the sister, her own eyes full of tears. "I weep," went on my wife, drearily, "for the brave, high-spirited girl, as frank as the day that I was that he slayed. I, who had never known what it was to be afraid, grew to be a trembling coward, living always in the shadow of a brutality with which I was too delicate of mind and body to cope. He called himself a gentleman and he never struck my body with his hand, but he beat my soul black and blue with jeers and jibes that cut me to the quick, and I came to always walk cringingly for fear of provoking him to some outburst of temper. For myself I could have stood his harsh words and bitter criticism. In time I came not to even especially mind them, for we can grow spiritually callous, but when he saw this and that he could no longer hurt me by his taunts, he learned a new trick, and tortured me through those I loved. My own misery I could endure without wincing, but when he made those who loved me suffer through their love for me, he brought me at last to his feet, ready to lie, to double deal, to do anything that would save them. I know, I know," murmured the sister, "a thousand times I have seen him vent his anger against the world on you." "I weep," said my wife, and her eyes looked afar off as if they scanned the dreary vista of the long years, for the loneliness that I have borne, the loneliness at first, of one who sits alone in an empty house and an empty room, afterward the spiritual loneliness of one who knows that one is tied to another who does not speak the same language, who does not comprehend, nor have one hope, nor thought, nor aspiration in common with one. I could almost laugh when I recall the dreams I had of a perfect comradeship with my husband. That was my ideal of married life. He and I were to work together, to climb together, to read and think together, to lead together the full life that no man or woman can live alone. Yet we had not been married 6 months before home palled upon him, and he wearied of me, and he went back to the old fast life that he had lived before he met me. In those first few months of desertion and loneliness, when I ate my heart out in silence, I asked myself over and over again, why did he marry me? Why did he not leave me at home with those who loved me? It is so cruel and inhuman a thing to take a girl's joyous young life in your hands, just to make it the wanton plaything of an hour. Many men are like that, said her sister. They use a woman as if she were a rose, to be worn on their breast for an hour and then broken and thrown aside. I weep, went on my wife, for my happiness of which he robbed me. With some women happiness does not matter much. They are only thin-blooded, joyless, unemotional creatures who never get anything more than a calm content at best, out of life. But I had it in me to be happy. I was born with the joy of living coursing like a mad torrent through my veins. I could have been wildly, deliriously, riotously happy. Little things gave me joy. A book, a picture, a new gown, a cheap jewel, a little journey, the glitter of a restaurant with its flowers and lights and music and beautifully dressed women, a fine play finely acted, the pulsing voice of a great singer gave me an ecstasy so keen that it is almost pain. It would have taken so little to make me happy, and yet I have not had that little. He took it from me. Because he did not enjoy the things that I did, I was never permitted to have them. Because he made himself miserable, he pulled me down into the slough with him. I have had nothing in all these 30 years, but hard words, but hard work, but the ceaseless heartbreaking struggle to keep the mantle of wifely duty pinned around my skeleton so that the world might never see it nor hear its bones rattle, nor know it for what it was. I have been robbed. Robbed, I tell you, of my happiness. And happiness was my birthright. I weep for my love that he killed. Do you remember what a sentimental girl I was, and how much in love I was when I was married? Poor little fool that I was. I thought him the embodiment of every heroic and knightly quality, and I loved him as Juliet loved Romeo, as Francesca loved Paolo. It has been dead now, oh, for years, but it makes me quiver still with pain to think of its death agonies. It died so hard, my beautiful strong love. It stood disenchantment and selfishness and cruelty, everything, until at last it starved to death. There was nothing for it to live on, you know, and so it just starved to death. I think I can forgive him everything else but that. But when you take a woman's love away from her, there is nothing else left for her in life to hope for or to live for, nothing. That is the end, and the end came for me so long ago. There was silence in the room, broken only by the hard, dry sobs of the woman that had been my wife for 30 years. Weep no more, said the sister soothingly, weep no more, it is all over with now. Yes, answered my poor wife drearily, it is all over with now. What might have been mine can never come back to me now. It is dead. Ah me. She did not know I was hearing all she said. She could not realize that now, as I heard her words, my whole soul shivered as if it were wrapped in ice. I was bound, it seemed, right there in the old place, for some reason, and knowing that I had died, I wondered vaguely why I did not begin to see some of the stretches of glorious heaven's land that I had oftentimes heard about in that old, strange life I had just left. I knew that every word my wife had spoken was true, and dimly the truth struggled up and grasped my senses, and I felt the awful reason why I was held there to hear those words of doom spoken, for really to me they fell like the pall of doom. A weary sense of hopelessness came over me, And I wondered if I should be always chained there to listen to my poor wife's just reproaches. Ah, me, a vision of her sweet youth came before me, and in looking upon it I wondered that I could have been heartless enough to destroy it. Then the old days of mad dissipation came floating before me, like throngs of black spectres, and shook their bony clattering fingers at me until I thought I should go mad with grief and despair. I could see everything in the room where she sat, could realize everything just as I could a few hours before, before the end, before death came. I had so longed to die, for I had thought that I should find peace in heaven through forgiveness of sins, or that I would find night's oblivion of darkness and deep unconscious slumber. But neither had been my heritage. I only stood face to face with woe, racked with despair. I tried to get out of the house, but I could not touch the doors. I always stopped just before I came to them. My hands clutched wildly to unbar my cage, so that I might at least get away from her, go away where I could not hear her grieving for all that she had had in the world, and that I had filched from her and then brutally killed her. At last, almost crazed with fear and sorrow, I threw up my hands in silent appeal and fell down on my knees imploring for help. I had not prayed since the last time at my mother's knee, just before I ran away from home. But I prayed now, prayed long and hard, until I was weakened, and bowed and broke into a flood of tears like a woman. And lo! As I cried I saw a light wonderful to behold, and out of it rose my mother with my only child in her arms. "My son," she said, "you got away from your real self by drink and bad company, long years of this so coarsened and hardened you that you murdered the heart of a woman, but when she understands she will forgive you. So I come to you, I forgive you. You prayed to your Creator, and you see I have been sent to relieve you and carry you away where you may have time to find yourself again and learn to be mother's good boy." I tried to catch her outstretched hands in mine, but she drew them back smiling sadly, and beckoned me to follow her. I did so. The Other Churches. Rev. James W. Canaan. Friends, you can very readily understand why professional evangelists should denounce spiritualism. It is because their system of religion is made up of fragments stolen from the Catholic Church and joined together by a theory of life, death and immortality which appeals directly to the imagination of men and their condition, which is ripe for a faith that will make them still more miserable. As a financial venture, their methods of calling sinners to repentance could not be changed without impairing the earning power of enterprise, for the credulity of their followers is the avenue to their pocketbooks, and the credulous ones always ensure success in that line. This is why they do not like spiritualists, for instead of the mourner's bench, the spiritual philosophy would recommend the thorough cleansing of both the inner and outer man, and would then suggest an uninterrupted continuation of that same condition of cleanliness. Again, they hate spiritualism, because spiritualists have contempt for a man who will reach down into the depths of any system of religion and snatch from thence all the clouds and leave the bright sunshine behind, as these fellows have done with the other churches. What amazes us most is that the Catholic clergy should berate and abuse spiritualists and charge, "If your philosophy is not a fraud, then you are in league with the devil." Now this should not be. Brethren should dwell together in peace and unity. We are more than willing to admit that the Catholic Church is the oldest and altogether the best organization for the propagation of spiritual philosophy on earth, and point with pride to the grand old Catholic Church, the custodian of more written and traditional evidence of the doctrine or belief in spirit intercourse and spirit materialization, than all the other religious societies put together have given you. In fact, every page of this history fairly groans under its weight of records of spirits walking, talking and eating here upon your earth, exactly as they did when in the material body. To be sure they were called saints, but when they first came back, they were simply priests and laymen, no better or no worse than the average priest and layman of today. They were enrolled in the catalogue of saints long years after they had familiarized themselves with the highway that leads between the spiritual and material worlds, and therefore, the privilege of returning to visit our earth friends is not granted by reason of canonization. Should you not be amazed then that the defenders and protectors of the Christ principle through all the dark and gloomy ages of ignorance and superstition should stand in the broad, glaring light of the civilization of the 19th century and, holding her official robes between her records and the world, say as did Peter, "I know not, neither understand I what thou sayest." They, the priests, have denied the Christ principle, therefore let the cock crow that they may be reminded of their faithlessness. Now where shall you find the evidence that the Catholic Church was founded upon the belief in spirit intercourse and that she defended that philosophy through all the ages? The Church's own history, as written by its own consecrated priesthood, is full to overflowing with officially attested evidence, and from that we shall quote, Saint John Joseph, 1734, immediately after death began to manifest himself, in his spiritual body. At the very hour of his death he appeared to Dij Pignatel, Duke of Monteleone, while he was walking about his private apartments. The Duke had seen him at Naples, a day or two before, sick almost to death, but he now appeared in perfect health and was encircled in light. Greatly astonished at the spectacle, the Duke said, "Father John Joseph, is that you? I am glad you have so quickly recovered." The saint replied, "I am both well and happy," and then vanished. The Duke then sent to Naples to make inquiries and was informed that John Joseph departed the earth life at the very hour he manifested himself to his grace. John Joseph manifested himself in a manner still more remarkable to Innocent Valet. While Innocent was asleep he felt his arm pulled and heard himself called aloud by name. He awoke in a fright and perceived a cloud of glory in the midst of which stood an irreligious spectre of the order of Saint Peter of Alcantara, considerably advanced in age. Valletta could not recognize the face of the apparition in consequence of the numerous rays of light which dazzled his eyes. The apparition asked Valletta if he recognized him, and Valletta answered, "No, I," said the apparition, "am John Joseph of the Cross, just this moment delivered from the bondage of the flesh, and am now on my way to paradise. If you would like to see my mortal remains, you will find my body in the infirmary of Street Lucy of the Mount." So saying, he vanished. Valletta hastened to the infirmary where he found a crowd of people weeping over the body of the saint. Subsequently, John Joseph repeatedly visited his old earth friends. Christ, as they called him, accompanied by a large band of spirits, visited Saint Vincent Ferrer and talked with him by the hour. Philip of Neri saw a multitude of spirits in and about the altar, and once, when he was ill, the Virgin Mary came to cure him, that is, to give him magnetic treatment. Street Barbara and a band of fellow spirits came to Stanislas Kestka and raised him up from a bed of sickness. Saint Benedict appeared to Bruno, Leo XIV, and cured him of a dangerous malady. After being stoned to death, Street Barbara's body was buried in an obscure place where it lay nearly 450 years. Then her spirit appeared to Antonius and pointed out the spot where her bones were lying. But what is the use of quoting further from these characters? There are more than 10,000 times such instances of spirit communication in the history of the Catholic and other churches. In fact, take away the belief in the power of the spirits to aid those in the earth life who appear to them and there would not be anything left of the churches, not even so much as a shell. Of course the professional evangelists deny the truth of these things, but they ought not, in all reason, to deny that Christ, after his death, was seen of Cephas, then of the 12 after that, he was seen of 500 brethren at once, then of James and then of all the apostles, for that is holy writ. Ezekiel, Zechariah, John and other men of Bible times saw numerous spirits. They were not only visible, but tangible to them. They saw temples, palaces, rivers and mountains, fountains, plains and trees. They say they did, and if these things were, then they certainly were before and are now. John said he saw people clothed in white raiment over here and also saw clouds and rainbows, books, harps, thrones, horses and chariots. According to the Catholic belief, deceased saints may be invoked, and can accomplish, either directly or indirectly, what is required of them. The belief of spiritualism is just the same, except that you do not call the spirit helpers saints. The highest degree of moral excellence is attained by the process of spiritualization, secured by the direct influence of good spirits, and the lowest depth of moral degradation is reached by the same process, with evil spirits as the guiding influence. Your spirit associates are those whom your present state of mind and heart attracts to your side. If you are angry, if you are thinking evil, if you are contemplating a wrong act against your neighbor or yourselves, you may be assured that your spirit companions are such as would delight in participating with you in the evil deeds. It is evident that the mind enters the spirit world in the same condition that it leaves the earth life, and hence all erroneous ideas of what constitutes spiritual happiness must first be eradicated before any progress can be made towards comprehending and enjoying the glories, and appreciating the blessedness of the true principles of spiritual life. Friends, death strips you of your robes of hypocrisy and deceit, and forces you to stand forth in the spirit world as you really are, and it is very certain that you shall not delay hunting up homogeneities' natures. Moreover, your associates will be those to whom you are spiritually related, without any reference whatever to your acquaintance with or knowledge of them in earth life, and it is well that it is so, or else you might be obliged to form associations that would be repulsive to all concerned. Some husbands and wives exist in continual dread of having their earth relationship continued in the spirit world, while there are others who are afraid they will not be reunited. You need not worry, only the spiritually allied remain together. Those who agree do not flee from each other, and there is no power in the spiritual world strong enough to detain them if they disagree. The Bible stories of spirit manifestations are deeply interesting to spiritualists, but none more so than the story of the king of Syria and Elisha, the prophet. It will be remembered that this king, so the narrative runs, warred against Israel, but somehow, the leader of the Hebrew army managed to outgeneral his adversary on every occasion, and the Syrian king, getting tired of being beaten at every point, concluded to ascertain, if possible, the secret of his enemy's success. In casting about for a solution of the matter, he was told that a man by the name of Elisha, a prophet of Israel, saw the man that pointed out the snares that had been laid for his people, and thus frustrated the Syrians' plans. So he concluded to send a strong force to Dathan, the place where Elisha was stopping, and capture the prophet, and away they went and surrounded the city. They got there in the night, it seems, for early one morning Elisha's servant discovered an immense army of Syrians encamped about the place. He was not long, we may believe, in acquainting his master with the situation, and in his fright he cried, "Alas, my master! What shall we do?" But Elisha was not moved by the sight of a hostile army, for he was one of the most highly developed mediums the world ever saw, and by his spiritual sight he saw not only one but many armies of spirits already in position to defend him. But being desirous that also his servant should see his heavenly surrounding that his fear might not get the better of him, he said, "Lord, O pray thee, open his eyes also that he may see." Elisha's prayer was immediately answered. And the Lord opened the eyes of the young man, and he saw, and beheld, the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire round about Elisha. They were to protect Elisha and his servant, and others too, no doubt, and they did it most effectually. The Syrian army was routed, horse, foot and dragoons. Of course the Syrians saw too, else they would not have become panic-stricken. Whole armies of materialized spirits filling the mountains with their numbers. Now this is a plain, unvarnished story from the inspired Word of God, and yet, you will venture to say, that there is not a Protestant or Catholic clergyman or layman in the city who will not try to twist the plain letter of the text into something altogether foreign to what the Bible plainly and distinctly says occurred. But with spiritualists this narrative will stand forever as evidence from the hand of God that you are continually surrounded by hands of spirits. Spiritualism, ancient and modern. Drummond. Out of the gloom and superstition of the past arises the new and strong truths of the present. Hanging away under the old tattered and disheveled cloak of years was the old codes, the old primitive spiritualism, drifting out of black art and unholy witchcraft and struggling forth into the light of the present day. So dark were some of the practices of those who in the past claimed to have and most assuredly did have familiar spirits, that the people of higher minds who walked in loftier planes scoffed to scorn all of the demonstrations emanating from these so-called low creatures. And that very atmosphere of scorn applied and practiced in ancient times, was the cause of the degradation and wickedness of some of these first workers in a cause, which shines today with the brightest of polished and faultless diamonds. And then too, the sensitives of the past, on witches as they were called, lived on an entirely different plane of environment than that upon which the mediums of today are living. Their elementary surroundings were of such a nature that they, most of them, really led low, groveling lives, and in turn attracted low and revengeful spirits around them. Such ones as would be glad to give information on a suspected criminal, for instance. It was a very common thing then for spirits of murdered men and women to surround the ancient sensitives and cause them to tell to the world the names of their betrayers. This practice alone caused much more crime and bloodshed, and those in power began to fear the uncanny things the witches were telling, for they knew only too well that every testimony was solid truth. So they commenced to hang, burn and drive these poor, suffering creatures from the country, when they were not really conscious of being guilty of any harm. It was not possible for them in the main to hold communication with the exalted ones, for they could not live in anything like our exalted realm of thought or feeling, for those around them caused their very lives to be utterly cursed with woe and crushing wrong. And how many years has had to pass before the cause they commenced to labor for came into a better understanding before the people? A great many mediums lived in olden times who gave forth their prophecies from dreams and so-called visions which were visited upon them. Great warriors led their vast armies entirely under spirit guidance through these wonderful mediums. There seemed to be in these past ages no effort to spiritualize the people by the practice and application of guidance from the other world, but each demonstration was put to the test for material ends entirely. Each spirit voice that spoke must need be heard to better in some way the earth, earthly. This state of affairs grew apace until all the people who believed at all in the psychic, vibrated, on this slow plane. For instance, if there was a maiden all suddenly lovelorn, she with one or two friends would seek out some witch's dwelling and, through the use of charms and incantations, her arrival was supposedly thwarted, when in truth these very incantations produced the elements of concentration and vibration, for a band of revengeful spirits to manifest in, and they ascended to earth even, and in all the strength they could command, cursed that unfortunate rival who had so heedlessly stolen the lover away. Many of the ancient kings were dethroned through the advice of certain of those individuals who entertained familiar spirits. And others' underground principles were carried on from year to year, through the simple power of spirit control, and the advice gained therefore, was in most every case used to further the people's own selfish ends. This state of things became so tense that most of the sensitives were driven from the land in disgrace, and others were burned and hanged. After all of this, the dawn of a new era began to glimmer forth on the wondering eyes of the people, for prophets and seers of higher degree began to be born to earth and they told forth much that was of a sincerely helpful and heavenly nature. Some of them were so externally spiritual in their attitude towards the people, that they, the people, fell down and worshipped them, and many called them gods. And in this epoch came forth our many saviors about whom the world is still wrangling and jarring. Each savior or medium who was born to earth had a mission, and was to clear away the old clouds and filthy stigmas of the past, and preach and teach the new gospel which should have been the gospel of spiritual truth, if the people had comprehended, but their mentality, at this time was on a crude plane of unfoldment, and ignorance plentifully mixed with superstition, caused them to rise up and blaspheme once more in the shape of burning at the stake, cruel death dealing wrong, and at last the crucifixion. Then as this epoch of time passed away, new and very different personalities began to be the lawgivers and enforcers, and spiritualism struggled in the hearts and minds of the people, until it began to show its force frailly like a tender plant never felt the warming sun's rays, until at last common intelligence began once for all to realize the great and overwhelming need of real spirit guidance in your dark world of people.